Not coming to you live from a basement in Ann Arbor.
Hello, and welcome to Words, the podcast where we talk about words and with the people who write them. I'm Phil Wittevine.
I'm Jack Bologna.
And this is The Beans. Today is February 15th, the day after Valentine's Day. You're listening to the fourth episode of Words.
This week, the theme we found running through the works we talked about was the human heart.
You'll hear a journalist talk about an artificial heart, a short story about a butterfly bursting from a heart, and an audio essay from me called I Hope I Have a Broken Heart.
But before we begin, we need to tell you where we're recording from.
On the fourth floor of the Ann Arbor District Library, in an actual studio.
For years now, a small book lending service called the Ann Arbor District Library, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Has been putzing around, and we're glad to give it the Words the Podcast bump.
We really think this is going to be the tipping point for this fledgling public institution.
It's like a Netflix for books.
Yeah, but it's free.
What the?
Anyway, in all seriousness, we're extremely pleased to partner with the Ann Arbor District Library. They're providing studio space, hosting on their website, and helping with production costs.
And this is Matt, the awesome library tech who's helping us record today.
Yeah. Let's wrap this up.
But without further ado, the human heart.
Plugged in through his chest, and air allowed blood to pump from his heart chambers through the rest of his body because his heart was not strong enough to do it on its own.
How do you leave my heart?
When I'm fully formed, I burst through it.
Won't that kill me?
Catherine didn't respond.
And mapping out everything that's going on in his heart and all the veins around it.
Feel free to hit pause, press the download button, and listen at your leisure. And if you want to learn more about our contributors, go to our website at www.wordsthepodcast.com.
So today we're sitting down with Jeremy Allen, a reporter here at the Ann Arbor News. Jeremy, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm, like you said, Jeremy Allen at the Ann Arbor News. I've been here in Ann Arbor for about a year now covering business in the community as well as the University of Michigan. Now I cover all the higher education institutions in the county, including Washtenaw Community College, Eastern Michigan University, Concordia, and some of the other satellite universities that are here. So before I came here to Ann Arbor, I was with MLive's Flint publication, the Flint Journal, where I was for about a year and a half. Jack and I worked together there for a little bit, where he interned with us there.
Yeah.
Good times. And I'm a two-time graduate of EMU, and so I have a bachelor's degree in journalism and a master's degree in sport management.
Can you just tell us a little bit about that story you wrote about Stan Larkin and his artificial heart? I mean, that was wildly popular from right there.
Yeah. So it took off really quickly and became kind of a social media sensation. So I found the story through a mutual friend of mine in Stan's. I didn't know Stan before, but I had seen a Facebook post from Stan's sister, and she talked about her brother being one of the first recipients of what's called the Freedom Driver, which is a portable device that allows blood to pump through the chambers when there's biventricular failure.
Yeah.
And so Stan had a heart condition from the time that he was 16, and he was 24 when he received this device last month. And so.
I loved how you opened the article talking about the sound it makes, like the galloping of a horse.
Yeah, I mean, when I had the chance to meet with him, that was the first thing you recognized.
Mm-hmm.
And
the sound of that machine.
Okay. It's the sound of the machine, and even when I speak to him on the phone, I communicate with him on a pretty regular basis. The sound in the background, the first thing that it picks up is the sound of the machine that's going in the background, where it's, you know, it's a really distinctive sound. And, you know, I really found it striking when I spoke with him. And, you know, the first question I asked was, you know, doesn't that noise kind of bug you a little bit? And he responded by saying, what noise? You know, he had been on the machine for about a week at that point when I spoke with him. And, he said after 2 or 3 days, he was just thankful to be able to have it, and that sound wasn't even an issue for him anymore. But it was a pretty amazing story, though, and you know, he's able to, prior to getting this Freedom Driver machine, he was hooked up to a 400-pound machine called Big Blue at the hospital, and it basically worked where it was plugged in through his chest, and air allowed blood to pump from his heart chambers through the rest of his body, because his body, his heart was not strong enough to do it on its own.
And so, I read somewhere that he was replacing a defibrillator. So instead of having like little electric shocks, he's actually having an external machine doing the pumping for him, right?
So right. Okay. That's how it worked. And so, again, with his heart not being strong enough to pump it, there had to be some outside forces. And so the way that the defibrillator works is that when your heart begins to not be strong enough to do that, it'll give it an electric shock, an internal electric shock, and say, hey, wake up. We need you to do what you're supposed to be doing. Okay. And so eventually the defibrillators just weren't shocking his heart strong enough.
Okay.
And his heart was unable to do the pumping on its own. So that's when they brought in the external big blue drive, to where they said, hey, we really need you, you know, something more to help you stay alive. Wow. And he was hospital bound for several months. Wow. Where he couldn't move farther than the tubes were on this machine. Mm-hmm. So his range of motion was maybe 12 feet for several months.
So. Could you maybe like describe Stan's condition, just like approaching it as like a non-professional? Like, you know, you don't necessarily, I guess I'm not necessarily curious about like the scientific underpinnings of like what exactly went wrong with Stan's heart, but could you maybe talk about the way he talked about his illness? This is something that he's carrying around with him everywhere, and that's the first time you hear.
How do you explain that, like in the grocery store?
Yeah.
So he said he quite frequently had people approach him asking him, you know, what this backpack was that he was carrying and why it was so loud. And for him, it was, you know, it was just life. You know, every day we don't think about the breaths that we take in and out. And he said that he had gotten to that point eventually with this machine. He didn't think about it as a machine that he had to strap to his back in order to live. He was just, it was part of who he was. And so he had come to that realization. But every day he said he was thankful for the fact that he had this technology that allowed him to be mobile, that allowed him to see his family, that allowed him to do everyday things that so many people often take for granted. So just from a non-medical standpoint, he was just happy to be, to have some sort of independence, while still his dependence really lied in the technology that he wore on his back every day.
I'm curious, was this your first time covering a story that revolves around cardiomyopathy, or have you had any experience covering any other stories?
Because it's really detailed. Yeah.
It is very detailed.
And was it hard to kind of write about like such a medical?
Yeah, I mean, I've written about medical issues before, but this was my first in-depth story that really involved this intricate technology. And so it was a huge learning curve for me in a short amount of time, and I had to sit down with this doctor who basically broke it down to me. You know, I told him that I was a novice, that this was my first real experience writing about a condition like this. So I did spend several hours researching the fine and seemingly minute details about what it took for him to live and what it took for this machine to work, and just all the things that it would take for somebody who had never studied this or heard about this before to actually really understand what he was going through.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got several emails following up saying that, you know, it was well done, and
yeah,
people who didn't know about this issue were able to learn about this issue because of how I broke it down and how I wrote it. And so
as
a writer, you know, as a journalist, that's a real payoff in it, when you're able to teach somebody something from the story that you write.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's of paramount. I think that's paramount in what we all try to achieve through our writings.
Yeah, I mean, it had like 11,000 shares, I think I saw last on Facebook.
Yeah.
It was just a great read, and you learned a lot, but it was a good article.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest, one of the most rewarding things for me, too, was I had a guy call me from, well, two people, actually. There was a lady who called me from Alaska.
Wow.
To tell me that she had read the story and how she had lost one of her good friends from biventricular heart failure.
Wow.
And so we had a very long conversation. She called me at about 10:30 Eastern time.
Okay.
And
at
so
night,
at night, yeah.
Wow.
And we talked for about an hour and a half about this.
Wow.
And it was just, you know, it really connects you. And that's really one of the things that I love about journalism. It really connects you to people who I wouldn't have spoken to this lady under any other circumstances, you know, but the fact that we were able to connect over this story about this one guy was really powerful. Yeah, really powerful. And there was another guy who called me from, he was a New York transplant from Western Pennsylvania. And I have some roots in Western Pennsylvania myself, so that sort of sparked up another hour-long conversation between the two of us. But he was a guy who was awaiting a heart transplant as well for a similar condition to Stan Larkin's. And so it's just amazing the way that, you know, writing and the way that words can connect people all across different spectrums, and people who you would never think that you would interact with, you can do so just by, you know, a story like this.
Yeah.
One thing that I would hope that a lot of writing would do for conditions like this is that when people read them, they really understand the importance of like signing up to be like an organ donor or to say because it's just something that you just sign up when you get your driver's license. I wouldn't be an organ donor. Mm-hmm. They put on your driver's license.
Yeah, and that was another thing too. The doctor, as well as both Stan Larkin and his brother Dominique Larkin, who was, you know, also featured in the story as well. He wasn't the focal point, but he is featured in the story as well. But they all talked about just the importance of organ donation, and several of the comments in the stories and the shares that I read from people's Facebook shares and Twitter shares and other social media shares, they were all, you know, just stressing the importance of organ donation as well. So I think it hit on a lot of different topics and subjects that people feel are really important.
So I guess, you know, it sounds like you really like this story a lot. Do you have a favorite story that you've ever written?
This one was pretty high up there for me, just because of the level of interpersonal connections that I was able to make with this. And, you know, as a journalist, I feel like it's our job to know a little bit about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And this was one of those times where I got to really just dive in. You know, and it was over a short period of time, but again, you know, over about a 3 or 4 day span, I was able to jam pack a whole lot of knowledge and information into my brain about something that I never thought of, that I was gonna, you know, just dive into like this.
Yeah.
So this one's pretty high up there on, you know, something I'm proud of having written,
yeah.
Something that was informative, and you know, it didn't come down to just click-driven journalism, which you know, I see in a lot of media today. It was really meaty, told a really personal story. So there was a lot of, there were news components, there were feature components, there were, you know, just informative components to the story that really made it, you know, one of the top stories that I feel like I've written. I officially took over full-time coverage of the university just before the fall semester started in 2014. And it's been interesting. I mean, the university is a huge part of the city of Ann Arbor.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, obviously it extends into Flint and Dearborn as well, but you know, it's like a city within a city.
Yeah.
And it's got its own centralized government as well. And so it's like, you know, just navigating the system, learning about the 19 different colleges within the university and navigating student life and understanding what's important to both students and the people of Ann Arbor is really important, because there are a lot of issues that you know, students might not be concerned about, but citizens of the city are concerned about, and vice versa. There's a lot of issues that the students care about that people in the city could care less about. You know,
so have you found like any specifics like that maybe you didn't expect, any specific issues that maybe you touched on and people really kind of connected with?
Well, obviously people like citizens of Ann Arbor care a lot about the growth and expansion of the university.
Yeah.
You know, they're buying up a lot of property. Mm-hmm. Last year was
the tax dollars, right?
Yeah. Right. It takes away from the tax base every time the university purchases a parcel of land in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that does is, you know, the city still has to maintain a base level of income.
Mm-hmm.
So other people's taxes rise when certain properties come off the books.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a good and bad thing, because resale value increases, which people obviously love, and that's why they buy in Ann Arbor, because they know resale value in 5 or 10 years is going to be through the roof.
Yeah.
But it also hurts people in terms of the property taxes that they have to pay, people who don't plan on selling or people who, you know, are lifers here. And so there's a lot of, you know, but there's a lot of give and take there. People definitely see the benefits that the university brings to Ann Arbor, and Ann Arbor sees, or in the university sees the benefits of Ann Arbor. And I've had a chance to talk with new mayor Christopher Taylor about those benefits, and I've also had a chance to talk to recently elected, or you know, relatively new president Mark Schlissel about those benefits as well. And they both seem to be forming a pretty good relationship with one another. The under the last mayor and the last U of M president, they didn't operate on the best of terms. And so it seems like with the new regime from both sides,
we're trying to get more interactive. And
right. It seems like a collective effort to make that relationship better.
Yeah, I did not know that. That's
I had a professor in the class I just came from, actually. She was talking about the differences between Marsh Lissel and, I forget her name.
Mary Sue.
Thank you. And she said that it seems like Marsh Lissel is a little more like centered on the student population, whereas like Mary Sue is more focused on like the business of running a university.
Mm-hmm.
I guess what I'm really curious about is what this like tension between like the university and the the municipal government is all about.
So it really comes down to, from what I've learned, the city doesn't want the school to continue the growth pattern that it's been on for the last couple of years. I mean, last year, the university was actively involved in about $1.2 billion in construction projects, which is the most that it's ever been.
One, right?
So when you have that much growth and that much expansion all going on at one time, it really puts a stranglehold on the city, because they don't, you know, the university didn't always feel the need to tell the city when they were going to undertake projects.
Mm-hmm.
And so the city sort of felt like, hey, we're being kind of undercut right now.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a huge standoff last summer between the university and the city about the pretty big property on South State Street, the Edward Brothers Malloy property. So it was a printing press on South State Street, 2500 South State Street, where the city wanted to purchase the property from this private business entity for about $9 million. And the university swooped in and said, well, we want that property too. We want to build a new sports complex there.
Mm-hmm.
And so they basically outbid the city and said, we're going to give them, you know, $12.5 million.
Wow.
And so the city had a chance to counter, and they didn't have any development lined up for the property, but they knew they wanted to develop it. They couldn't justify spending $13 million on the property without having people lined up to do something with it. And so because of that, they lost out on that enormous tax base that they were coming in. Edward Brothers Malloy was a top 10 taxpayer in the city that comes off the books now because the University of Michigan owns the property.
Wow.
And so you have standoffs and strongholds like that occur within the city and the university.
Mm-hmm.
That just, you know, they just cause tension between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one couldn't survive without the other.
Yeah.
You know, if Ann Arbor didn't have its great restaurants and great arts community, then it would detract a little from the people who come here for those things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you talk to any student, if you say, you know, what are the top three things that drew you to Ann Arbor? You know, one of them would be the great food scene. Another would be the excellent quality of life that you can gain from being an Ann Arbor resident. And again, the other would be like, you know, just the art scenes. They have great entertainment venues around here that people just love. And so if Ann Arbor stepped away and said, hey, we're going to stop providing these things, you know, as a backdrop to the university, the university would suffer. On that same token, if the university said, you know, we want to pick up and move back to Detroit, you know, the city of Ann Arbor would just be left in the cold from that. I mean, neither of those things would ever happen. But
so far we've talked about real estate, cardiomyopathy, and and student life. And so it's like what you said, a job of journalists is a little bit about a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
In your year that you've been covering Ann Arbor, specifically the university, the city within the city, are there any patterns among the varied things that you've been studying and writing about that you've been picked up on?
When you look at a pile of rocks, how do you know which rock to turn over, you know?
That's a good question.
Yeah, that is an excellent question. I think what you really have to do is just really get out and know your audience. And so that's what I've spent a lot of my time doing when I first got here. There was a trial and error period where I would write things and some things didn't pan out, didn't come to fruition like I thought they would be. Things that I thought were interesting weren't necessarily interesting to the, you know, 10,000 or 20,000 devoted readers that we have on a daily basis.
Can you hit me with an example?
So when I covered Flint, it was a real blue collar town. You know, everybody cared about the auto industry. Everybody cared about the chamber of commerce and their activities in the county. Here, the auto industry is not a huge deal. And so you find that out. I mean, unless it's like Toyota developing a new technology for a vehicle, you know, that Toyota has a technical center here in the Ann Arbor area. And so unless they're doing something major, people don't really care about, you know, a factory that's coming here and building car parts or scooter parts for that matter. And so things like that just don't really resonate with the people. But if you write a story about a new restaurant opening up downtown, people go crazy about it, you know, because everybody wants to know. There was a couple students who graduated recently from the University of Michigan, and they decided to open a restaurant dedicated to salads. It's called Salads Up.
Yeah, I saw that. I'm like, what?
Located on East Liberty. But if you look at that story and the amount of attention that it drew, people are like, oh yeah, we really do need a salads restaurant. I mean, you can get a salad from any restaurant in the city, but it's like that's sort of what resonates with people, you know, or you know, any amount of spending. Anytime you write a story about the university spending money,
yeah, people eat that up.
People want to know about it because, A, they feel like it's in their backyard, and they just want to know how this, you know, $9.7 billion endowment is working, and, you know, and so... Not only that, but it's a state university, and people invest in it whether they want to or not through tax funding. So yeah, they feel like they have some sort of say or investment in how the university operates. We all know that's not the truth, but those eight board members called the regents really control the dollar flow. But yeah, so those are just a couple examples of what people really digest here in the community.
You said, I like your line about knowing your audience, but that's an interesting thing to say because the audience that you're now writing for is changing hugely, right? I mean, just in the story that we talked about earlier, like you got the story from the audience, and then
it
became a big deal like via all this social media. So I guess my question is, do you find like your job has changed now that so many people are like self-published essentially on like social media, or like so many people are more independent?
Yeah, I mean, it was Ann Arbor audience, but this piece you wrote had a much larger audience.
Yeah, it depends on the story also. Mm-hmm. You know, some stories have global audiences, some stories have statewide audiences, some stories have U of M student audiences or Ann Arbor centric audiences. Yeah. And you know, I think the topic on which you're writing dictates your audience. And again, you sort of know. I knew going into this that people of all backgrounds, the Stan Larkin story, I knew that people of all backgrounds would be interested in this. I knew that, you know, he has friends in the Ypsilanti area. He has friends in the Ann Arbor area. He has friends in the Monroe, Michigan area. And just people all over. You know, the University of Michigan's reach is so expansive. And then when you get into, you know, heart surgery, that's something that, I mean, cardiovascular disease is a huge reason for tens of thousands of deaths in America every year. And so when you write a story that's powerful like that and has the ability to impact people just because of the range or the breadth of the topic, you cater your writing style to that audience. You know, if I'm writing a story about an organization at the University of Michigan, I don't need people in Alaska to be able to relate to it. You know, so I'll write it very centric and very specific to the audience in which I'm catering.
Yeah.
But it is, I mean, it is difficult at times to navigate, though, like you said, because there are so many different people who are considered distributors of news now. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody with a Twitter account is a distributor of news. Everyone with a Facebook account is a distributor of news. And so I think it works, and not only just a distributor of news, but
an eyewitness.
Yeah, I mean, they don't discriminate on how they present news. And so I was reading a piece the other day about how there was a pretty well-known journalist who was dissuading people from going into journalism. And he was saying he was dissuading people from going into journalism because he said, you know, it's not an art anymore. But there were some points that he made that I agreed with and others that I disagreed with. But he said it's not an art anymore because anybody can serve as a mouthpiece for news and the distribution of news.
Well, I mean,
At this point in the interview, we invited Ben Fried into the room to tell us a little bit about newsroom antics.
In any industry or in any profession, there's a lot of hijinks that goes on. That's part of being in any profession. Any newsroom you go into as a young person usually has fun things. So one of my first weeks on the job here, I was going to be interviewing someone who's more important in town. He's, you know, leader of a business, and I figured I'd wear a suit because it was kind of an important guy that I was going to be talking to. Usually we all dress nicely here. I mean, you walk around, you see people in the button-down slacks, nothing too fancy, nothing too not. So I wore a suit and a tie, and when I got back to the newsroom, everyone was like, wow, Ben, you know, really, really dressing up today. And I was like, oh yeah, of course, you know, it's Friday. And they were like, what? I was like, you know, formal Friday. And they all just started giving me a hard time about it all day. So then the next week, I came in again with a suit and tie on Friday. And so now, Jeremy can tell you, every week on Friday, I do formal Friday.
Yeah.
And over time, some people in the newsroom have joined me. I sometimes get a few other people to go the suit and tie route. But the best time was our old editor, Tony Deering. Before he left for New Jersey, came in totally unannounced one week on a Friday in, like, full tuxedo. And this is back when he had an office with a door. And so whenever he would come out of the door in his office in his tuxedo, I thought he was, like, about to present an award to someone or something. But it was just, you know, a funny little thing that kind of just sprouted out of a random occurrence that is ongoing to this day.
Yeah, I think Formal Friday kind of spurned a couple other, Purple Thursday.
Purple Thursday happened for a while. That's kind of gone downhill. Okay. None of the other ones Purple had the staying Thursday, power of Formal Friday. Right, that one... And by staying power, I mean I'm the only one who does it. Other people would, like, these other ones that kind of were more flash in the pan would gain a larger following, but they didn't have the staying power.
It's almost like a metaphor for, viral stories in journalism. You know,
we tried to.
That story was a real Purple Thursday. Your reporting has been a great formal Friday, you know.
Wow. I'm going to have to start using that now. I like that a lot. I like that. I'm going to. Yeah, when we like report something, then just let it go for a while, I'm like, yeah, it was a Purple Thursday story. But yeah, I mean, it's just. Yeah, go ahead.
Also, not too many people know this, but. Mm-hmm. Ben is the CFO of the office. CFO standing for Chief Fun Officer.
Oh,
so.
I thought that was like Fritos.
Also, Fritos can be part of the fun.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Under that umbrella.
Yeah. Wow. So, the other night, Ben and I were responsible for an almost viral hashtag on Twitter.
Hashtag T Swift like a journalist.
T Swift advice for young journalists.
Yeah, I thought that was a great. Yeah.
So, advice for young journalists was trending nationwide, and we both, I think, sort of hopped in on a serious note, and we tweeted some serious stuff, and then,
for the record, he hopped in on a serious note. I tweeted no serious advice for young journalists.
Well, so one of my last tweets was. Advice for a young journalist, haters gonna hate. Mm-hmm. Ben comes up with the, you know, being the CFO that he is, comes up with the T-Swift advice for young journalists.
Right. Prior to that one, I think my best, I had tweeted out two. One was a Rickrolling that got a couple of people. I was pretty proud of myself for that.
Yeah.
And the other one was phase one, acquire sources, phase two, phase three, maybe make a little money. So there was no serious stuff coming from me. But the T-Swift, I have had a long T-Swift infatuation that anyone in the office can tell you about. That's the other fun thing is, I mean, people just start playing music in here. One of our reporters, her ringtone is all about that bass. So that usually gets us going pretty well.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we just started tweeting out Taylor Swift lyrics that some were modified, some were not. I think so one of the modified ones was like, never forget how it feels to be dancing around in your PJs before writing a kick-ass A1 story. But, you know, it was just fun. And that's part of the thing is, I think, especially being a journalist, being in a industry that is so much in flux and can get depressing at times when you have commenters telling you that you need to go back to journalism school because you missed an apostrophe somewhere or things like that, that you do need to bring a sense of fun and a sense of levity to the job. Because a lot of these Advice for Young Journalists tweets, just to go back to that, were very, you know, Advice for Young Journalists, you know, learn how to drink well, or Advice for Young Journalists, like, you know, it only gets worse, and all these kind of like very downer things that, you know, you have to remember that we got to have fun with this, and that we're doing a really important thing here as journalists, and we need to take our job seriously, but we also need to have fun together. We need to have a sense of camaraderie. We need to just be able to enjoy ourselves in addition to the obvious important and hard work and sometimes thankless work that we do.
Friday, February the 13th, and we are here in the studio with Jeremy Berkowitz to talk with him about his story.
Catherine the Caterpillar.
Catherine. Little baby Catherine.
Yeah. Jeremy, we usually like to start off with like a little bit of a roadmap of the story, so kind of listeners know what it's about. If you could give just a little bit of a plot synopsis.
Yeah, so basically there's this kid, he's 5 years old, his name is Richie, and he has a mother and father that are just terrible parents, and... One day he wakes up and he has a cut between his index finger and his thumb. And basically what happened is this caterpillar has crawled inside his veins and is crawling to his heart to form a cocoon. And so the whole story cuts back and forth between Richie in a coma, his mother upset about being in a coma, and the caterpillar's experience within the inside the body.
But the mother is so selfish too, you know.
The mother's a terrible person.
The dad is like basically not even there.
Yeah, the dad's basically non-existent.
Yeah, that happens in a lot of stories, you've noticed.
Yeah, dad's just drop out.
Dad's drop out.
Yeah. I don't know, I wanted it to kind of be like a creepy children's story, I guess, and a lot of those the parents are kind of missing and avoidant.
Yeah, so was that caterpillar based on like a real caterpillar? Is there a caterpillar that does this?
No, there's not that I know of.
Where'd you get the inspiration for it then?
I got the idea because Howie Mandel, when he was a kid, you know, he has OCD. And supposedly part of the reason he has OCD is because when he was a kid, a bug implanted his larva into his skin.
Oh, God.
And so that was going on. I mean, I can tell you a lot if you're asking more background to the story. You're just asking if the caterpillar's a real caterpillar.
No, yeah, please, like, continue.
Just go.
All right, just go. So basically, I was pretty manic and depressed. I was all over the place. And this story is basically about, I wrote it right after this girl took my virginity. She was a really good friend.
Wow.
And so the heart of it is someone coming into your heart and taking it for themselves and then walking away with it.
Wow.
That's brutal.
That's, yeah, man.
Though, especially... I'll say, our relationship was not that intense, so I don't know why I got this from it, but...
But no, I mean, let's read from the part when the caterpillar bursts out. And listeners, you should know that this caterpillar actually has an ongoing conversation with Richie, and we actually get inside the mind of the caterpillar. But yeah, if you could read just that section.
Yeah, so Catherine, the caterpillar, hears this voice. She starts conversing, and then...
conversing with Richie, yeah.
In that moment, wings sprung, the cocoon broke, Catherine broke through the heart, the bone, and skin. Richie had no chance to even take a breath. Catherine was excited. Her whole life was for this moment. As doctors rushed in, Catherine roamed the hospital looking for a way out. But first, a door opened to a women's bathroom. She was taught this was where humans admired themselves. She wanted a chance to do the same. In the door, around the corner, she hits a mirror. No, no. Catherine is red. She is drenched in red. This is everything she did not want. She took an innocent life just to become red. This must be blood, she reassured herself. Flying into a toilet, she could feel the red disperse from her body. Flapping her wings, she returns to the mirror to find a blue metallic coat resting upon her. I knew I was the best in class. I knew it.
And Catherine then is referring to the Caterpillar class that she was in.
Yeah, so there's a school that Catherine keeps referring to the whole time, Caterpillar School, where they train you how to do this process of becoming a butterfly.
Mm-hmm. So why does she hate being red, though? And is that kind of anything? Because I did not know that the story was based on, you losing your virginity and perhaps having more of an emotional attachment to it than you had expected.
Why red?
Why does she hate being red?
Yeah, is red a symbol? I mean, is red just red, or I guess the question
I think
really...
it was just in my mind when I was a kid, and I saw a beautiful caterpillar that was metallic blue, and it always stood out to me, and I thought just she would want to be that color. I don't know.
Yeah. So this is kind of an interesting question. I think a lot of times guys are like, oh, man, how do I write girl characters? How do I get inside the mind of girls?
It's really hard.
And then girls, say, like, how do I write guy characters?
Yeah.
How do you write caterpillar characters, because we get a lot inside of mind of Catherine. Yeah.
How do you write caterpillar characters? Yeah. I don't know. Honestly, this whole thing, I just kind of sat down for 4 hours 2 years ago and spit it out. Like, there was no planning or anything. I didn't intend for there even to be these conversations they have or anything like that. I didn't even know that she was going to go into the heart when I wrote it.
Wow.
I just kind of, it just happened.
Yeah. You just let it develop.
Yeah.
It's very fortuitous that it did, because then we could have you on for our Human Heart episode.
Yeah.
But, I guess I mean, a lot of the women characters I write are just heavily based on women that were in my life. So. Mm.
I guess the question that I have is, creatively, not necessarily real life, but how did that 4 hours start? Like, how did that story actually begin when you were writing it?
It began just like the first line. In the night, a caterpillar crawls beneath Richie's skin between his thumb and his index finger on his left hand. Like I said, I was just really manic and in a bad place. And I'd been writing for 2 years. I'd been writing all these stories based on this other girl that I'd been with. And I just decided it was time to completely separate from that. And I guess the only thing I knew how to do was pick a different girl.
Huh. This is like way off topic. I picked up the story, and then like when you said that, I went back to the beginning, and the first thing that came to my mind was Heartless by Kanye West. So I was like, in the night, I seen him crawl, the coldest bug you ever saw.
Holy shit. I am a huge Kanye West fan, and he gets pretty manic and depressed too, so I don't know. Maybe I was listening to some Heartless.
So writing for you then, is that like a therapeutic thing?
Yeah, it's definitely a therapeutic thing. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, this story was just like a challenge, because I was in a creative writing class and I kept handing the same shit. And I was like, my teacher liked it, but I wanted to prove I could do something different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What, and so just give us a little taste. What are some of the other things you like to write about? I mean, I know because you're a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And I saw, what was the name of that?
It was George O'Duncan. So
George O'Duncan. That was a good one.
I can talk about that. George O'Duncan's a short film I made last year. I wrote, directed, produced, basically starred and edited the movie and did production design for it. It's about a guy named George O'Duncan from an alternate universe called The Aven, where he finds out his testicles are going to burst, so he has one night. He has one night to impregnate a girl before they burst. Meanwhile, back on Earth, there's a kid named David trying to lose his virginity before the world ends, and I'll just ruin it because no one's going to see it. In the end, you find out that George is God, and the Earth and the Moon are his testicles.
But the best part is the best part is when he's in the doctor's office, and the doctor's like, "You have this condition where your testicles are going to explode."
Yeah, Colleus Rompere. Yeah.
Yeah, and the guy's like, "What?" And then like he just like points to these signs like on the wall, and like there's like these like hilarious signs diagramming like exploding balls, as if like this doctor just has like already ready made, and it's like dun dun dun.
Yeah.
So what's the kind of stuff that you, I mean, so we know that you write about butterflies exploding from hearts,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and exploding testicles.
Yep. Okay.
What explosions, else is in your wheelhouse?
It's all about the money shot.
Yeah, all about the money shot.
I'd say pretty much all of my ideas are either based on emotions in connection to women, and this isn't just like women I've dated, like this is like my grandmother, my mom, just something about women, I don't know. And then or it's just like I say to myself with George O'Duncan, I say to myself, what if I was God and my testicles bursted? So I just implant myself like Richie, like I implanted myself in Richie, but I tried to make Catherine the main character so I could get away from the constant thing of me being the main character.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is a drastic move away from balls bursting to hearts. Yeah.
Yeah, I believe that in life, the greatest form of happiness and pain comes from the body, and everything else is replication. So
wow, can you go into that a little bit more?
Yeah,
because that's really cool.
Awesome.
That's way too fascinating way too to leave on its own. So we need to hear what the rest of it is, I think.
Should I repeat it or what?
Yeah, just like go into what has led you to think that.
So I believe that in life, the greatest form of pain and pleasure and the purest form of happiness or joy or pain comes from the body. Eating, drinking, sex, you know, shitting, whatever. I hope that I can still get a job if someone reads this. Or
hey, we all do.
But, you know, and then everything else is replication. So, like, movies are replication. Like, you watch a movie and it builds up to the climax and the letdown. That's a replication of sex. Like, everything's a replication of eating, the joy of eating, you know, stuff like that.
Is that a Freudian ideal? Or are you taking
It's probably Freudian. Okay. I probably don't come up with the things I say.
But
I can't fucking wrote Heartless was my opening line of my story.
But no, that kind of takes me back to when we were talking with Brendan about his poetry mm-hmm. and about life versus writing about life. Mm-hmm. And like, it's like, at what point do you stop writing about life and actually just start living, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that ties back to the idea of like, you know, replicating or trying to replicate life in media or art. Or writing.
So I guess by your own definition, what you've written here is a piece of replication, right?
Yeah, we're all just trying to replicate that pure basic joy and pain.
Uh-huh. So what,
okay,
if it's not too personal, what's been the purest joy or pain you've had in your life?
Purest joy and purest pain.
Yeah, let's just do both.
Purest joys would be eating pizza.
Yeah.
And
what kind of pizza? That.
I mean, any fucking pizza. I used to eat pizza 3 times a day for my meals.
Dorm life, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I like New York pizza. I like Chicago pizza. I like the fucking Mexican pizza. I don't eat Mexican pizza, but I mean, it's totally different.
Okay.
But yeah, pizza. And then I'd say, the greatest joys, I'd say pizza, laughing with friends. Laughing is a bodily thing, I guess. And that look a girl gives you when she really cares.
Wow.
That was really cute.
What is that look?
Whatever.
Can you give me that look in studio, maybe?
Yeah.
Try it.
Give Jack. Oh my God. Whoa.
Valentine's Day. Sit down, fellas.
He's blushing.
That's not the look. I can't do the look, man.
Guys, we have water here, so don't worry. Just like, make sure you stay hydrated.
Yeah, because I'm feeling a little thirsty right now. Okay, sorry. So for Valentine's Day, what's the pure, like the purest, worst feeling or...
That's the purest pain.
The purest pain.
Yeah. Someone you care about in pain, and you can't help them.
Oh, that's good.
Do you think sometimes you can have like a pure pain and a pure joy?
Simultaneously?
I think to like, you know, like going like on a long run or like a really tough run when like you're like just spending everything you can like in a race and like your body's just crying out and it's just like this pain that you've like never felt before, but like it's so...
It's called catharsis.
It's liberating.
So... I guess, do you feel like peak experiences like transcend that good bad dichotomy? Like, are there things that are just like beyond words? Is there like an experience?
Nothing's beyond words.
Do I personally have an experience that's beyond words?
I don't know. I guess I'm just kind of curious about this. There's a philosophy underlying the way you write, I think. I don't know. If that's
the philosophy behind what I write is life is pretty fucked up and depressing, and sometimes there's comic moments along the way.
Amen, brother.
And that every story should begin how it ends. A person starts out as A. They get through the story. They've learned to B. Now they are A and B. They don't lose A. So is this? So like, I don't know. I just spew stupid philosophical bullshit sometimes. I could just end up saying nonsense.
That's a major theme of the show.
I think that you just like off the cuff paraphrase like. Really like well-known theory of creative writing, which is called recursion. It's like it's basically like everything in a story proceeds from like its first sentence, and it only ever builds on it. And the great quote about that is you start with it, you have the same objects through the entire story, but you only darken and deepen them kind of. So like it's the idea that you start off with like a limited amount of stuff A.
Mm-hmm.
And it just like kind of builds on itself until it reaches A plus B, I guess. So I don't think that's bullshit. I think that's like kind of insightful.
Yeah, I think by the end B refines A, and they kind of like fuse in a way.
Yeah, but I know this isn't maybe this is an oversimplification, but I kind of don't like it sometimes when especially like in workshops when people seem to emphasize the need for like a resolution or an arc. I mean, I think almost every story I write like doesn't really have, and even this story doesn't have that much of a resolution. I mean, obviously Richie dies.
Yeah. And then the mom gets infected.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, it's, so I guess that it kind of starts anew, but like Catherine dies too though, you know?
Yeah.
And like, I don't know, I didn't think that was going to happen throughout the story, but that kind of just, it makes you wonder like why, I mean, it just kind of casts a huge shadow on the story because it's like, well, why the hell did Catherine even kill Richie then, you know?
Yeah.
Did you ever think like, why did you choose to kill off Catherine at the end? I mean, I can tell why, I definitely know why you had the mother infected because the mother was terrible.
Yeah. And like, I chose to kill Catherine off because I felt like I didn't want her to get away with it.
Okay.
She was, I understand from Catherine's point of view, she had to do what she had. I want to, I was considering changing the name. I want to clarify. I wrote this in 2013, and then in 2014, I dated a girl named Catherine.
So this is not about that.
Yeah. This is not about you, Catherine. Okay. Burn.
Well, I wasn't trying to say that. I'm just saying if someone's listening to this, I know. I don't want them to think, like, he specifically named the story. Whatever. I just wanted to clarify.
I absolutely need to, like, say that I had the exact same experience with a Carolyn
and
a Carly.
Okay.
And, yes, I just totally get what you're saying.
Okay.
When I was reading this story, I was waiting for her to like emerge from the chest and be like, "I'm Catherine the Great," and then like,
classic Yassine moment.
The beans. Yeah, sorry, Jeremy. That's Yassine.
No, like, sorry, I just zoned out for a second.
We lost our guest.
Yassine has a brand of humor where he says something completely ridiculous, and then he holds on to it. And that is what makes it so perfect.
Yeah, he never, yeah, devotion to the joke.
I think repetition is key to humor.
Mm. Yeah.
So I think the coolest part in the story, the part that I really liked, was when Catherine started talking to Richie. And
yeah.
I did not expect that to happen.
I didn't either when I wrote it.
Yeah, I guess why, how did that happen? Why did you make that decision? And maybe we could read a little bit of that dialogue too at some point.
My name is Catherine.
Catherine, where am I?
How old are you, dear boy?
I'm 5. How old are you?
Only a few months old.
You must be a baby.
I am not a baby.
What are you?
I'm a caterpillar.
Why can't I see you?
I am inside you.
Where inside me?
I have cocooned in your heart, and I will soon phoenix into a butterfly.
Richie didn't understand half those words, but he knew he had a heart.
How do you leave my heart?
When I'm fully formed, I burst through it.
Won't that kill me?
Catherine didn't respond. He could live. There were a few ways. If she stayed within his heart as a cocoon, it was possible he could become immortal, and she immortal within him. And they could talk, and they could keep each other company. This is what her brother Matthias intended to do. They banished him from Caterpillar School when they found out. She was never quite sure if he succeeded in his mission.
Hello, are you still there?
Doing that would leave her ugly, not fully realized. Was immortality worth more than beauty? It can't be. Beauty is everything. Poor Matthias was such a fool. She doesn't regret that she was the one who told him of his desires.
Yes, you will die.
But I am only a child.
If I let you live, I will now die.
I don't understand.
That's of no importance.
What is the life of a butterfly like?
You fly, you mate, you feed, you die.
I could do more, but I never could fly.
And that is why I value my life higher than yours.
Why me?
Your hand was where I crawled.
Richie wanted to say something, but he didn't know what. Catherine thought of how she could save him another way. All she had to do was crack the cocoon. All she had to do to crack it was dig. And if she dug, she could crawl through his blood and skin and exit from where she came. But then she may never find another host to penetrate, and she would almost certainly die in red.
But yeah, some of that dialogue really crawls underneath your skin, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, not
even. That was my joke. You stole it.
Wow. So yeah, it's Jack making bad jokes now.
Jack.
I really like the part where she says, I will soon phoenix into a butterfly. Is that an actual verb? Is that what
I just made it into a verb.
I mean, I liked it. I mean, I love like using words that aren't verbs as verbs.
I love it when you recognize something that you've never seen before.
Thank you.
Yeah.
What?
So, but why, I mean, you kind of discuss it, but like, why ultimately do you think Catherine makes that decision? And because, you know, she knows her brother did it, you know, that her brother did not kill the host. Why does she think, I mean?
Why does she follow through with it?
Yeah, I mean, I know you have
this. I think she's just selfish and vain. Like she says, it's more important to be beautiful than immortal.
Wow. So, did you, how bad was losing your virginity, though?
like I said, I think this was more going on than just the virginity. Like, the girl and I were friends. It wasn't like it was a big deal. I was just in a really bad place just in general, I think. And so it wasn't exactly her that I felt. I think it was just life in general ripping my heart out.
So you're doing better now, though? Or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was going to say, because it's deeply connected to the story, I wasn't sure if I should bring it up because it's in the public airways, but I always say fuck it because I think it's important to get out. I'm bipolar, so this is just very, I was in a very, like, you asked if you can experience pain and pleasure all at once, and so there's times when I'm manic and depressed all at once, and that's when I wrote this story.
Wow.
Right on, man.
Yeah, seriously.
I know, bipolar is like, it's serious, so I mean, that's cool.
That's what, I'm just going to come off like a total rube, but that's what the Silver Linings Playbook is. Protagonist. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay. So that's my little cultural thing I can attach to. But
I feel like if my parents listen to this, they'd be like, you shouldn't say that out publicly. But I just think it's an important thing to just get out that people have these things going on.
There's a lot of things that people like don't say. It's more important to say it, to have the conversation, than just to like let it be like a stereotype or a stigma.
Yeah. I think that's the worst when people don't talk about like eating disorders or depression or just things that they feel awkward about or things that are essentially the things that make us human.
Like virginity.
But I don't know. And then I'd spent like the past week running around campus like a crazy person, you know. I was like, it's time to maybe try and focus this. I remember before I learned about bipolar disorder, I learned there was a writer who just like wrote a novel in 2 weeks. And I was just like, I want to be bipolar. I want to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And then I guess you get what you wish for.
Damn. Wow. Well, do you mind talking us through that experience? Because that would have been in 2013, right? Because that was before you knew.
2 years ago.
Okay. So you were dealing with bipolar completely unaware that you had this
disorder. No, I knew it was going on since my 18th birthday.
Oh, okay. All right.
Well, I had things going on before that, too, but, you know.
That's the
so
time.
So it goes and so on.
So how does writing, I guess, fit into, I don't want to say overcoming, but how does that stand in relation to your bipolar then for you? I mean, you talked about that a little bit.
I mean, I couldn't have come up with George O'Duncan probably if I wasn't bipolar. I don't know. I mean, it definitely does. I mean, they say a lot, like supposedly Kurt Vonnegut was bipolar. There's just a bunch of people you read about. Mm-hmm. It definitely fuels some sort of creativity.
Yeah.
Like, that's why, I don't know, like, if they ever had some sort of thing where they could remove it from me or cure it, I would not accept it.
Yeah.
Even if, like, there's bad times and good times, it's totally, it's worth it. It's worth every second of it.
It's life, man, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, even, it's something that you go through, something that you start off with at A, you know, when you get to B, you don't want to excise it, you just want to.
Well, it's been a real pleasure sitting down with Jeremy Berkowitz, and we're really happy to have been able to talk to you about your story,
Catherine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Keep writing.
And the link to this story will be in the show notes, so you can read the entire thing at your leisure. And so this has been Words.
It's been Words.
Cut. I've taken a yelling cut.
I liked it.
Stop recording.
You just press the stop button, but I think when we're in there, it's just going to be recording the whole time as much as possible. I can just go through later and cut out.
All right. It might be a half an hour kind of thing.
Yeah, it's fine.
I might, like, pull up my computer and do work if it's a boring part of your procedure.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, just feel free to say whatever's on your mind and what's going on inside there.
Okay.
If you have any thoughts about anything that you want to pontificate on.
This is an audio essay entitled, I Hope I Have a Broken Heart. We were just listening to me explain how to use the recording software on my computer in the lobby of the radiology department at the University of Michigan Hospital this past Thursday. But before I talk about the CT scan they took of my heart, I need to tell you how we got here. More than 2 years ago, my face started to swell. The medical term is facial edema. It was my dad who first noticed, but I would consistently brush off his concerns. It occurred predominantly in the morning after I'd been drinking alcohol or beer the night prior. On New Year's Eve 2 years ago, I, like many Americans, drank an unnecessary amount of alcohol and beer. When I woke up the next day at the crack of noon, I trudged into the living room, and my housemates reacted as though I were a stranger. The swelling was so bad that I could feel it without even having to touch my face. My friends found this funny, that I had this apparent reaction to beer or wheat or alcohol or something. I thought it was a cruel irony, because my parents, especially my dad, didn't approve of me drinking alcohol. So I denied it. I kept drinking, and the swelling persisted. I wasn't delusional, though, as sometimes the swelling would occur when I hadn't had anything to drink. This past summer, for example, I went backpacking in multiple national parks across the country with one of my best friends, Eric Straley, and I would wake up in the tent, and my face would swell, as large as it ever had, despite drinking no alcohol. Eventually, I got my act together and saw some doctors. I got blood drawn and lots of needle pricks. They ruled out allergies to wheat or alcohol and found that I'm not allergic to anything. Then they ruled out problems with my kidneys or liver that might have caused the swelling. Next, they ruled out celiac disease and other autoimmune diseases. The next guest was SVC syndrome, or superior vena cava syndrome. That's why I got a CT scan on Thursday.
Where are we?
I don't know. I've got gray hair, though.
Where are we right now?
The waiting room of the radiology department. We're in the radiology department at the University of Michigan Hospital.
What for?
B1.
No, but why? Why are we here?
We're here for Jack's big appointment with the radiologist.
You can speak
radiologist.
Up. It's not that big. It's a pretty small deal, I think.
It's a small deal.
Hopefully.
It isn't a big deal. My dad is worried always.
Is that where the gray hair comes from?
Exactly.
All right. His hair isn't that gray. It's just a little gray by the temples.
I didn't have gray hair until I had Giacomo.
Yeah, but that was, yeah, that was 22 years ago.
I know. It's come in since that time.
SVC syndrome is when there is a pressure on a vein leading into your heart, which causes blood to pool in the face. It happens most when you sleep or are lying down because gravity is not helping to drain the blood from your face. In the past few weeks, I've tried sleeping sitting upright, and while it's uncomfortable, it's been helping. I see some of the angularity that my face used to have. So I really hope it is SVC syndrome, because if so, they can fix it, and I can get my old face back. I hope I have a broken heart. But let's go back to Thursday in the waiting room.
So, are you all ready for this?
Yeah.
Are you worried or scared?
No, I'm excited.
All right.
Because hopefully they can tell me it's SVC syndrome and they can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got my old face back.
Would they do a balloon angioplasty or something like that?
I don't know. I don't even know what that means.
They would kind of like send a balloon up into the artery and then kind of open it up.
I don't want to think about that, but I guess maybe.
I never really thought much about how my facial swelling affected me until about a week and a half ago I was at the doctor's office, and the doctor said that it must be hard to look in the mirror every morning and not see yourself. I was a little stunned. No one had ever said that to me. I almost started to cry. People who've only met me during the last 2 years don't know what my face looks like, or at least what I think my face ought to look like. Here, my dad and I talk for a while, and then a nurse comes and calls me back.
Or maybe neither. Yes. Okay.
Right. Sounds good.
Is he allowed? I hit pause and ask if I can take the recording equipment back with me.
No.
No.
Oh, so none of it?
No, he's going to get changed right now and get an IV started. It'll still be about 20 minutes until the scan.
Wait, an IV?
Yep.
I thought they said I could take the drink.
Oh, you don't have to have a drink for a chest
CT. What if I preferred the drink as opposed to the IV? Not like if I have a
not
fear
of...
Oh, God. Okay.
So all I had called the radiology department beforehand and asked whether I would need an IV. They said I wouldn't. I don't like needles, and I was a little upset about this.
Jack has just found out that he does have to have an IV. which he's been looking forward to no end, as you can well imagine. As he said earlier, the last two times he's had to have a small amount of blood drawn, he has passed out. He has not eaten for the last 4 hours in preparation for this, so his sugar levels are probably a little bit on the low side. And my guess is that this is not going to be his favorite thing in the world, but he'll get through it.
My dad is now alone with the mic as I get changed and wait for not one, but two IVs, one in each arm, to be administered. Right outside the changing area, there's this mini lobby where I had to sit and wait for the IVs. I was already shaking with nervousness and feeling clammy when I picked up a black notebook from a table in the room. There were instructions on the wall to not remove this book from the room. So I ripped an empty page from the back, and like any good journalist, I started recording what was written down inside this book. I've got this this ripped out page with me right here. I wrote down some notes. There's a lot of people inside of it that were asking for health, that were thanking Jesus. People that were with family members in the room wrote like notes to their, you know, their dad who was maybe sick, or their mom or family members. Some were really specific, but others not. There was one that simply read, "God bless this facility. Thank you." There were some that were people that had been like multiple years cancer-free and were coming back. There was this one that that read, "The dead know only one thing. It is better to be alive." And then it went on to explain that this individual had had over 100 surgeries in 37 years and 3 times was administered last rites. And this note ended with, "I'm staying." So this book, it was exceptionally powerful. It was kind of overwhelming. You know, I wasn't sure when the nurse was coming back, but it didn't really feel right to skim through these notes. And I kind of wonder now today how many of these people that wrote in that notebook are still walking this earth. The book calmed me down and put things in perspective. I was self-conscious about my face, but all these people were fighting for their lives against cancer and other horrible diseases.
I'm guessing about now that if by chance they've decided to put the IV in Jack and nobody's come out to get me, that he's been successful in having that IV put in.
And then my dad comments about what's playing on the waiting room TV.
How apropos is this? In the waiting room of the CAT scan, they've got the Hallmark channel, and it is the Love Weekend. And as you can hear in the background, they are showing a rather sappy movie in regards to a wedding, playing the standard music that you would hear at all the tacky weddings.
I want to thank the nurse who administered the IVs. She got me a warm blanket when I felt clammy. She reassured me that plenty of people fear needles and IVs, and she listened to me talk incessantly because I was terrified that if I stopped talking, I would pass out. But when I came back to the waiting room before the CT scan, I was still shaking.
Okay, so we're back recording.
All right, so what have they done so far?
They've given you this beautiful look. They gave me two IVs.
Two?
I was very upset about that. Yeah, they're one in each arm.
Okay.
And I hate needles. I did not pass on them, really proud.
Yes.
The nurse was really nice. She let me just talk incessantly for like 15 minutes.
So what did you tell her?
Just like anything and everything.
No family secrets.
No family secrets.
All right, good.
I'm still shaking a little bit because I'm a little bit nervous.
That's just normal. Plus, you haven't had anything to eat in 4 hours.
I know, and they're like, let me just stick these things in your veins.
I know.
It's terrible.
I've got some like little cookies for you when you get done.
That would be great. But yeah, now it's just, I'm going to have to go back in a little bit.
Yeah.
And I guess I'll do the CT scan.
Okay.
Shouldn't be that long.
Did they already give you the dye?
That's the IV is for.
So they already put it in.
So yeah, okay, podcast listeners, right now, yeah, if you can see, I don't think my dad wants to look. But there are like these two like syringes.
That I won't look at all.
Crook. And I guess there's some kind of fluid they need to see.
It kind of flows through, you know, all of your veins, and then it goes through. And
yeah, I guess.
How does it ever get out? Did they have to take it back out again?
I don't pass out.
Then my dad and I took a selfie, okay, which is actually posted on our website right now.
I should probably get going back in there, though.
All right, well, have fun.
Yeah, thanks.
This seems pretty simple so far.
So far, I haven't passed out.
They did give him these nice little pants, too, so as he walked away, we didn't see anything inappropriate. something I've been talking to him much about in regards to his podcast. Keep it clean, I say. We want the 14-year-olds and 12-year-olds to be able to listen as well. He doesn't look afraid at all. He's walking in there much better than I would have. I would have fainted by now, I'll tell you the truth. I mean, anytime you have things hanging out of your arms, whether putting in or taking things out of your body, I just don't handle.
And again, in my absence, my dad started rambling on about Valentine's Day.
And chocolate, too. Why do we always give chocolate on these kinds of days? Chocolate's bad for your heart. Except for maybe dark chocolate.
The CT scan didn't take very long. I had to lay down on this bed that went back and forth in and out of this large, whirring metal donut while they pumped water and then contrast into my bloodstream.
That was it? You're back?
Yeah, I'm back, yeah. I didn't pass out.
It didn't take any time at all. It's like...
It was, yeah, it wasn't that long. They had like put like this fluid in the IV things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And like it made my skin like really warm, and I thought I was peeing myself too. I guess it's like a thing that made and this weird metal taste in my mouth.
Yeah.
But then, I didn't pee myself. He's checking. Yeah. And I didn't.
Then I badgered my dad about how he felt while I was getting the scan. I wanted to get him to say he was scared because he loved me, which, looking back, was pretty selfish.
Giacomo, I'm hoping that this all turns out well. I'm sure it will.
I'm sure it will, too.
Yeah. And I think that it's always good to be proactive in regards to your health.
Definitely.
And not wait for a long time.
Yeah.
So when your parents are saying, because they love you, get to the doctor.
This is
going to
turn
things into
a giant lecture for you.
Well, I thought that's what podcasts were for.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So you can kind of lecture out there. I mean, not lecture at people, but, you know, I work in the healthcare industry myself, and so does your mom. And everything we've ever read and heard and researched
about. Go see a doctor.
Go see a doctor, okay. You know, before things get, you know, dangerous. Or,
why? Because?
Because you want to know ahead of time.
But, you know.
You don't want to be in stage 4 cancer. You want to be in stage 1 cancer.
I was looking for the part where, you know, like the emotional, you know.
Oh, that part too, yes.
Where you're just like.
Because I love my doctor. Did you hear that, Dr. Walker?
Yeah. That's a great answer.
And I love you, Giacomo, yeah, too, always, no matter what.
Yes.
Okay?
All right.
Do not forget, or else.
Yeah.
And then my dad explains how his father expressed love and affection.
Like one more thing?
One more thing, yes. You know, in the prior generations, dads didn't tell their sons that they loved them. They just knew it.
Okay, so
especially
this is a new thing. That...
when they hit them, you know, kind of whomped them and said, like, hey buddy, you know,
Papa
straighten up.
You,
yeah, that's how he showed his love to me and his father, too, as well.
Right.
Like, you've got to peel those cabbages, you know, that meant, I love you, son, and you move a little
cabbages faster.
Exactly.
Okay.
So.
All right.
Just so you know what love used to be.
But as I was going through the recordings my dad had made while I was getting the IVs, I heard something that made me feel really bad about having badgered him.
Well, Jack's concern has always been whether we loved him or not. And seeing that this is a audio recording, a podcast in regards to love, one of the things that has always... I think bothered him at times is that a belief that his mother and I didn't love him at a certain point in his life.
What my dad is referring to is a time about 3 years ago when I stopped going to class and almost failed out of college. I'm glad to say that I figured things out and started going to class again and took some classes that I really love. When I graduated from the University of Michigan this December, I did so with a 3.5 GPA that semester. And I learned so much and I really loved it. But even just 2.5 years ago, when I felt lost and unmotivated, my relationship with my parents was extremely tense, and it was rough.
There were times without question that we didn't like Jack, that he drove us nuts or gave us gray hair and worry, but never has there ever been a time that we haven't loved him deeply and thoroughly. So as he goes for his heart checkup, you could say, to rule out one possible issue, I think it's important for anybody listening to the podcast just to kind of remember that. Your parents always love you. They don't necessarily always like you or what you're doing, but they always love you.
The results came back on Friday, and I don't have SVC syndrome, so we still don't know why my face swells. And that's pretty disappointing. I want to know what's causing the swelling so I can get it fixed and move on with my life. But I don't consider the CT scan a loss. That message from my dad was the greatest Valentine's Day present I've ever received. I've got something to say to you too, Dad. You gotta peel those cabbages. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Remember to tune in next week.
Words was found on a cold, rainy Friday night by the side of the road, sobbing sweet nothings into a Chipotle napkin, after which point it was...
Holy words, Phil! Again?
I'm sorry. You know, I thought
come
it was
on.
Gonna, oh, whatever.
Words is produced in cooperation with the Ann Arbor District Library. Words is hosted by The Beans, Phil Witteveen, and Jack Bologna. Jack Bologna is the show's creator. Brandon Reich is the director of the Ann Arbor Poetry Blast. Diane Thatch is our artist. And you are the listener. Now... the outtakes.
And he keeps going. Non-stop.
Hey, Jack. You know what the Midwest is?
What's the Midwest?
Young and restless.
Young and restless. Restless.
Did you really misplace an apostrophe?
It happened this one time. No, it's... I don't like to talk about it.
Which can only mean one thing. It means that Subway ran out of napkins, so they went to Chipotle and they stole a bunch of napkins and they brought them back to the union and put them into the dispenser.
And we'll make sure we link to the story so our 20 listeners can know.
21.
Oh, okay.
No. You know, that's like the running joke for a podcast where, like, we'll send this to our X number of listeners where X is always a low value.
Yeah, but
X is increasing,
down.
Right?
It used to be like 5, and like now it's, then it was 10, and now 20.
Now we're joking about 20, we'll get to go, we're joking about our like 5,000 listeners, and we're just like, that's not good enough.
Well, they used to have a Mickey D's on South U. You know
what?
Yeah, like, there's this weird, like, male voice that's like, you know, breathe in, don't breathe, and like the machine whirs up and there's these giant like magnets going around in the circle around you, and you're just thinking like, don't pass out, and you're trying not to move because they tell you not to move, but you're nervous and you want to move.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't pass out.
It was a two-story McDonald's.
Go ahead,
there was
again,
a
Jack.
Two-story McDonald's. Oh my God. Could you imagine how much McDonald's we would eat drunk